Okay, so good morning, everybody. We're going to start our session. So we'll have two talks this morning on atmospheric circulation, and Adam will start. So please, Adam.
Hello. So I'm going to talk about atmospheric circulation models on giant planets, so mostly hot Jupiters, but I'll also discuss a little bit about giant planets in our solar system. And this talk will be followed by Ian's talk. And so I'll try to give some kind of broad overview, being the first of the two talks. I'll talk a lot about my own work. I'll also try to describe that from a number of the other groups that are working in this area. But I'll leave, since Ian has a talk right after mine, I'll let him describe his own work. Okay, so first, as has been pointed out before, we have a sort of ground truth. The giant planets in our own solar system, which of course differ in many ways from those that are very close in orbits around other stars, but still we should try to use what we can from these planets and see if we can extrapolate sort of the theory that's been developed within the solar system and for the giant planets and for the Earth to the exoplanet regime. So this shows visible wavelength images of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune to scale, and of course you can see these banded cloud patterns. And the dominant circulation pattern that is seen when these clouds blow around in the winds is a series of banded zonal flows, or east-west jet streams. That's seen in these bottom four plots. So each one of these is showing the so-called zonal wind speed, east-west wind speed in meters a second, versus latitudes, the equators in the center of each plot, North Pole, South Pole. Scales are different on each one. Scale got cut off here, but this is from 0 to 100 meters a second. And so what you can see for Jupiter and Saturn is that the circulations are divided into numerous alternating east-west jets, or eastward-westward, eastward-westward. These wiggles are not noise. They are a very regular and reproducible pattern of the jet stream. So what that means is that, for example, a particular region of the clouds might be moving eastward, the next one down to the west, east, west, et cetera. The whole planet is shearing apart. If you see a movie of it, it's of course a fluid, it's not in solid body rotation. So movies of Jupiter look very dynamic. Same general picture for Saturn, a few less bands. Uranus and Neptune have even a broader pattern of bands, more similar to Earth, Earth's upper troposphere in some ways, with what seem to be high latitude eastward jets and then broad westward flows at the equator. And the speeds tend to be sort of 100 meters a second peak speed for Jupiter, up to 400 meters a second or more for Saturn and Neptune. Okay, so just a very brief few words about sort of the background ideas for what causes the east-west banding in these atmospheres. The giant planets in our solar system are all very rapidly rotating. They have rotation periods ranging from 10 hours for Jupiter at the short end, up to 16 and 17 hours for Uranus and Neptune at the long end. So all faster than Earth, and that means that rotation plays a dominating role in the dynamics. And in particular, what has plays a huge role in setting the morphology of the flow is the gradient in the strength of the Coriolis force with latitude. So the angle between local vertical and the rotation vector is a function of latitude. And so the gradient in the Coriolis force that results is referred to as the beta effect. And the beta effect is one of the dominant factors that leads to banding in planetary atmospheres. This shows a series of very idealized calculations that just solve purely two-dimensional equations of fluid mechanics on a sphere, non-divergent horizontally, so a constant density on a sphere. And this is a so-called freely evolving or decaying calculation, where a bunch of turbulence is placed in the initial condition, but there's no sort of large-scale forcing or damping. The flow evolves over time. This case is non-rotating, and it produces a bunch of vortices of opposite signs, cyclones and anticyclones, and they are essentially isotropic. So I could rotate this plot by 90 degrees, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. There's no preferential singling out of east-west versus north-south. At intermediate rotation rates, things start to change, and at very fast rotation rates, you can see a persistent zonal banding is occurring. So the beta effect is the only process in this simulation that can produce anisotropy. This is such an idealized simulation. There's no gradient of sunlight or anything else. The gradient of the Coriolis force is the only thing that's causing this. As well as its interaction with the turbulence. It's worth remembering also that Venus, which has a rotation period of 243 Earth days, also has a banded flow, at least in the clouds and below that, which suggests that, depending on the parameter regime, transition to a banded flow can happen at very low rotation rates. the transition from sort of a flow that appears to not be dominated by rotation to one that is dominated by rotation may depend on the wind speed and other factors, but this is a point worth bearing in mind. So most planets are going to have at least some degree of banding. And the giant planets in our solar system, and in general, there are a couple of key length scales that help determine the length scales of the dominant flow structures. One of these is the so-called Rhine's length scale. So this is, U here is the mean wind speed. Just, you know, if you're thinking about Jupiter, for example, you can just pick a characteristic observed value, say 30 or 40 meters a second. Beta, as I referred to, refers to the gradient of the strength of the Coriolis force with latitude. So the square root of this quantity is a length scale. And it turns out that if you plug in the numbers for Jupiter, then this is similar to the value of the width of Jupiter's bands in kilometers, sort of. 5 to 10,000 kilometers. And turbulence theory suggests that this is a natural scale at which rotation tends to cause east-west elongation. So length scale smaller than this, then turbulence tends to be more horizontally isotropic, whereas at length scales larger than this, it becomes banded in the east-west direction. The Rossby deformation radius can be expressed as a buoyancy or gravity wave speed c over a rotation rate. And this is a natural scale of vortex formation and flow instability. So for example, baryclinic instabilities, which are quite important in atmospheres, tend to produce structures, have their dominant growth rates near the deformation radius. So they tend to produce flow structures with sizes similar to the deformation radius. And so an interesting point is that on Jupiter and Saturn, both of these length scales are much smaller than a planetary radius. Deformation radius is maybe a few percent of the planetary radius. A Rhine scale is maybe 10% of the planetary radius, give or take. And so as a result, Jupiter and Saturn have numerous banded zonal jets and very small vortices relative to the planetary radius. On hot Jupiters, however, it's generally thought that at least for the very close-in ones, that they're tidally locked, which would mean that their rotation rates are in general going to be slower than those for the giant planets in our solar system. That doesn't mean the rotation is negligible, but still, if you decrease the rotation rate by a factor of 10, so a typical hot Jupiter, instead of rotating in half a day like Jupiter, rotates in 3 or 4 or 5 days, then the Rhine's length is going to be a factor of several larger or more, and the deformation radius would be an order of magnitude larger, holding other parameters fixed. And so in general, we expect that hot Jupiters will have flows that are more global in character than Jupiter and Saturn. And this is actually good from the point of view of characterizing these bodies from near disk integrated observations. It would be a huge challenge to do so if the planet's meteorology was like Jupiter. If we had, you know, 25 jet streams, half of which are going east and half of which are going west, all interleaved with each other, we would not be discussing sort of single hot spots shifted off of a substellar point. So it's worth bearing that in mind. And you know, so far the dynamical models support this sort of scaling argument that on hot Jupiters the flow should be relatively global. But still, it's worth bearing in mind that it's not necessarily the case that you can that there's a very simple global scale flow geometry that can be inferred. That may not be true in general for hot Jupiter or for exoplanets, for example. Okay, just a brief word about the state of the art in understanding the circulation in the giant planet atmospheres in our solar system. So this is sort of a 30-year history. There's been a lot of nice work, some by people in this room, extending back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, very idealized sort of turbulence calculations that do pretty well, actually, in producing the banded flows of Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. There are details that folks have been arguing over, like what are the exact mechanisms that produce the superrotating, so-called superrotating or eastward jets that are observed for Jupiter and Saturn, in contrast, for example, to the broad westward flows seen on Uranus and Neptune. This shows an example from one of my graduate students, Yuan Lian, who graduated about a year ago. So this is a three-dimensional calculation that uses the same numerical code that we've been using to simulate hot Jupiter atmospheres, for example. It shows the development of numerous zonal flows. This is what's being plotted here is the zonal speed, the east-west wind speed, meters a second. And so you can see these sort of alternating east-west jets for Jupiter and Saturn, and a broader pattern for Uranus and Neptune. Okay, so there's a lot of details that are still not understood. These simulations don't produce sort of great red spot type features, for example. But you know, at least we have a little bit of confidence that you know, we can do okay on giant planets in our own solar system, and then hopefully that would also be the case for hot Jupiters. Okay, so just to remind you, Heather and others have talked about this at length. So these are the kinds of observations that get us excited and that we, in the long term, are going to be trying to explain. So light curves from Spitzer, for example, were transit, secondary eclipse, and then the increase in brightness as the planet's night side rotates out of view and the day side rotates into view, gives information about the day-night temperature contrast and even about offsets, as Heather and Nick Cowan have discussed. Okay, so I skipped a slide here by accident. So let me discuss, before getting into any modeling details, the dynamical regime of hot Jupiters. The circulation is driven, we think, by global scale heating contrast. So a typical hot Jupiter absorbs sort of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 watts per square meter of stellar heating on the day side and would have a comparable amount of IR cooling, infrared cooling on the night side. And so we have this global scale forcing. As I mentioned, the rotation rates are expected to be synchronous with the orbital periods of typically 1 to 10 days. This suggests Coriolis forces are important but not dominant. Rossby numbers might be of order 1, speaking in non-dimensional terms. An interesting and important point is that in most cases for the close-in planets, the weather is occurring not in a convection zone, like might happen when people talk about convection in Jupiter's deep interior and whether that can drive zonal flows, but instead in a radiative zone that extends from observable levels down to perhaps 100 to 1,000 bars, depending on the age and composition and other details. This, there's a number of groups working on this. This just shows one example from Fortin et al. 2007. So this is a series of calculations of planets at different distances. These different color, the numbers in different colors refer to the orbital separations in AU, assuming a sun-like star. And I believe these are all 4.5 billion years old, probably. Yeah, so out here you have the hot Jupiters, and so you can see sort of a quasi-isothermal profile. This one here on the right would then transition to a convection zone much deeper even than the plot. And then for more and more distant objects, you can see the transition to the convection zone slowly rising, between the radiative and convective zone slowly rising. These ones on the far left are sort of Jupiter and Saturn type parameters. And the convection zone is shown in the thick line and the radiative zones in the thin line. So the point is that for the close-in planets, but not for Jupiter, we have this very deep radiative zone. And it's worth bearing in mind that the sort of weather, quote unquote, that we're discussing is occurring in that layer. Okay, if one does very crude order of magnitude estimates of the radiative time constant and how it might vary with pressure, and if, for example, you were to assume a wind speed of sort of a kilometer a second or something, the advection time to advect air across a hemisphere, if the wind, say, a kilometer a second, is of order a day, and a crude estimate of radiative time might suggest that radiative times are less than that advection time at pressures less than, say, a bar or a tenth of a bar, whereas the reverse would be true at greater pressures. And so this might suggest, just from simple timescale arguments, that we would have large temperature contrasts aloft and then small temperature contrasts at depth. Again, these sorts of arguments need to be quantified in more detail, but this just gives a general picture. Okay, another very crude kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation. What sets the wind speeds? This is actually, there's a number of subtle layers that one could, at which one could answer this question. But just to give a crude sort of sense of order of magnitudes, so that you can understand when, somebody like, my group or Ian or other groups, refer to a particular wind speed that they're getting, you might wonder what it is that sets the order of magnitude of that. So for example, suppose that at some deep layer in the atmosphere, there's no winds and the isobars are flat. And then if there is a day-night temperature difference, delta T, and if that extends over a range of log pressures, delta log P, and if R is the specific gas constant, namely the universal gas constant over the molecular mass, and if it's a global scale flow, hence if it's a global scale pressure, horizontal pressure gradient that we're talking about, then this quantity would give the order of magnitude of the horizontal pressure gradient force in the upper troposphere. And suppose, for example, that this is balanced by horizontal advection, so V dot grad V, to order of magnitude, this is sort of a wind speed squared over, let's say, a planetary radius if it's a global scale flow. So if you were to set these equal to each other, then you get something like this, that U is sort of the gas constant, delta T, delta log P, all to the square root. And you can see that if you look at this, this is basically the speed of sound. That if the if delta T is comparable to T, there it would be a gamma for the speed of sound instead of this factor. But to order of magnitude, you can see how you can achieve wind speeds that approach the speed of sound. And this is purely sort of a result of force balance in the presence of order unity or fractional order unity changes in the day-night temperature difference across the planet. So to put in some numbers, if the day-night temperature difference is 400 K and delta log P is 3, then you get 2 kilometers a second. So this really would be interpreted in that case as sort of a variation in the wind speed across the planet. Okay, so when one builds a three-dimensional circulation model, or so-called general circulation model, there's a number of components that go into it. So first, you choose a set of three-dimensional dynamical equations. The ones that I'm going to be describing use the so-called primitive equations from atmospheric dynamics. They're a subset of the Navier-Stokes equations. This shows the horizontal momentum equation, so advection, pressure gradient term, Coriolis term, source terms. Key assumption that goes into this type of model is so-called hydrostatic balance. Instead of treating the vertical acceleration terms, those are replaced with a local hydrostatic balance. So it's important to, and the coordinate here I should state in this system, the way I've written it, is longitude and latitude in the horizontal and pressure in the vertical. And then so instead of the pressure gradient force being expressed with a pressure, it's expressed with a geopotential. Details don't matter if you haven't heard of this before, but key point is that the assumption is made is that the vertical acceleration terms are small compared to the hydrostatic terms, and this really results from having a large aspect ratio. So this assumption is only valid if the vertical length scales are smaller than the horizontal length scales, which is generally true in atmospheres. So in the case of if you're thinking about global scale flows on hot Jupiters, and if the vertical scale height is a couple hundred kilometers, and you're interested in flows on a planet scale of a planetary radius of 100,000 kilometers, then this ratio is sort of several dozen to 100. Okay, so thermodynamic energy equation, one puts in a heat source or sink. To really specify the model, you have to specify, of course, not only initial and boundary conditions, but in particular, if there are any source terms, for example, in the momentum equations, and what to do about this radiative heating. So there's a number of choices. So-called simplified general circulation models solve the equations with highly idealized representations of radiation, surface drag, and so on, if there is a surface. The most simple one is, for example, Newtonian cooling, where you just specify some radiative equilibrium profile, hot on the day side, cold on the night side. It's just some pre-known function you put in. Maybe you calculate it offline from radiative transfer calculation. Tau rad is a radiative time constant. So this is a relaxation that if nothing else were happening, it would e-fold the temperature structure in the model toward this assumed TE over a time scale of tau rad. But of course, that can never happen because if you're trying to make it hot on the cold on the day side and cold on the night side, the circulation is always going to be pushing you away from radiative equilibrium. And so in general, even if you're treating the radiation more realistically, you're never going to be at a radiative equilibrium. And the case with a terrestrial planet, or even if one were parameterizing drag on a gas giant, one could, for example, have drag, so-called Rayleigh drag, where you just again put in a relaxation of the winds. Full GCMs in the Earth, for example, have complicated boundary layer schemes where they parameterize the turbulence. So it depends how, you can get realistic if you want and put in representations of radiative transfer clouds, subgrid scale processes, and so on. The solar system community, a full hierarchy of these kinds of models, all of which are useful. Okay, so let me show you some results from some work that we've been doing. So this shows the results from a general circulation model, which to the Earth folks would still be quite idealized. We don't have, for example, any subgrid scale processes in here. But the main advance that we did over previous work was we coupled it to a realistic non-gray representation of cloud-free radiative transfer, namely the model that Mark Marley and Jonathan Fortney have been using. So we have coupled the two, and then this shows the results for HD189733b, assuming a solar composition, and the opacities are calculated assuming local chemical equilibrium at each grid point, which has been discussed, is of course a simplification. This is showing the temperature structure at three different model levels as a function of longitude on the x-axis and latitude on the y-axis. And then the substellar point is here, and you can see that there's an offset of the hot spot from the substellar point. And then there's a eastward so-called superrotating jet that develops in the simulation with details that vary with height. So, but at least to zeroth order, this has the structure that Knudsen et al. Light curves have of having this eastward offset of the hot point from the substellar point. One can compare light curves from observations and the models, as is done here. So we have some similarities and some differences. Likewise, with secondary eclipse spectra, so these are calculated offline from the GCM results. These are Spitzer observations, and then the two curves on here show solar and 5x solar three-dimensional simulations. And then this is emission spectra. We've also calculated transmission spectra from these same simulations. See Fortin et al. 2010 for that. Just to show a little bit of what some of the other groups are doing, this is some work that James Cho has done in collaboration with others, published a couple years ago. This is kind of a placeholder. There's a poster in this conference by Thrasterson and Cho where they extend this to sort of 3D models, so I encourage you to take a look at that. Again, it has in common, although details differ, it has in common with the simulations that I already showed of having just a few jets, typically 3 to 5 jets in the final state. This shows some simulations from Menno and Rauscher, 2009. This is forced with a Newtonian cooling scheme, like I described. And shown here in color is the temperature difference with arrows showing the winds. And this is actually qualitatively similar to the 3D simulations that I showed a minute ago, where you get an eastward equatorial jet, mean westward flow at higher latitudes, and sort of a displacement of this region away from the substellar point. The key difference in this case is that there is strong time variability to the flow, which was not seen in my simulations. So you can see that there's a wavy structure on this equatorial jet, which is time variable and leads to a time variable distortion of this temperature field that, if real, would potentially be observable. I should mention that this model assumes it's what they call a shallow model. They put the boundary at 1 bar where heating is still occurring. So I'll return to that point in a couple minutes. This is a follow-on from flipped author order, Rauscher and Menno. So in this case, they changed the boundary condition and put the boundary deeper, which is also what we do. So put the boundary down at a couple hundred bars. Again, this is forced by Newtonian cooling. And again, the pattern in this case is even more similar to the pattern that I see in my simulations. You get an equatorial eastward jet, sort of mean westward flow at high latitudes. And in this case, the flow is much more steady. This is a plot showing work by Tommy Koskinen, who's here, and he, I think, also has a poster here. This is not quite in the same ball game because he's doing the upper atmosphere, meaning nanobar pressures. So, the model is way above what the rest of us that are doing that I'm describing, but still very related as far as dynamics. So I encourage you to take a look at that poster. If you put in a species that absorbs greatly in the visible, then you can produce the so-called stratosphere. This shows a simulation similar to the one I showed previously, but we put in TIO and VO, and has been discussed at length. This may or may not exist on these planets, but for the purposes of this simulation, this is really just should be viewed as a proxy for how a stratosphere would interact with the dynamics. You really could put in anything that absorbs in the visible in the simulations and get a similar result, as long as the opacity was similar. So at deep levels, you have a sort of hot day side that's with an sort of a displacement, substellar points in the center of the plot. Aloft, you get this huge hot region on the day side. So the temperature profile you can see here has sort of the stratosphere. One, again, can also calculate spectra from these. So on the night side, then you get, sort of very deep absorption bands. And then on the day side, those flip into emission because of the reversal in the temperature profile vertically in the stratosphere versus on the night side. Okay, so we've also done a bunch of work, which is not yet published, where we vary the parameters like rotation rate and orbital distance, and there's some interesting effects that can occur. So these are parameter studies. These are not real planets in the sense of being planets on the list in all the online archives. We did sensitivity studies around HD189733b, so that's this case here, at a distance of 0.03 astronomical units with a rotation period of 2.2 days, and then What we did is this whole row is at that same distance, 0.03 astronomical units, but we varied the rotation rate by a factor of 4. This is 4 times slower, so a rotation period of 8 over 8 days. This is 4 times faster, so similar to Jupiter's rotation period. And then this is at an intermediate distance, and this is the most far away from the star, about 0.2 astronomical units. So a factor of sort of 50 in stellar flux and a factor of 16 in rotation rate across this plot. And so you can see in these cases, so the cases down here are slowly rotating and they're very strongly illuminated. And what's being plotted on here is the, in color, is the zonal mean wind speed, so the east-west wind speed averaged over longitude, plotted as a function in each case of latitude and height. So deep pressures at the bottom, low pressures aloft, and the center of each plot is the equator with one pole and the other pole. So you're looking at a cross-section, a meridional cross-section through the atmosphere. Red shows eastward, blue shows westward. So you can see the equatorial superrotation in these simulations with sort of weaker westward flow on more poleward latitudes, and that occurs in all these slowly rotating, heavily forced cases. But when the rotation rate gets fast and or the distance from the star increases, then you shift into a different dynamical regime where instead of having the peak zonal winds on the equator, they happen in the mid-latitudes or even the high latitudes. So that's what you see in these simulations in the middle. So that's almost more qualitatively analogous to the circulation pattern in Earth's atmosphere, where in the troposphere you have westward flow at the equator and then the jet streams in the mid-latitudes. And in fact, we're diagnosing this now, so I don't have anything firm to say about it, but the dynamical processes have a lot in common, that there are probably baryclinic instabilities happening that help form these jet streams. And then if you go to this case up here, this is the most rapidly rotating and least illuminated of these simulations, and you can see that the jets split into, in each hemisphere, there are two eastward jets with a westward or minimum in between, and then a westward flow at the equator. And so what's happening here is that as we're going up in this direction, the wind speeds are weaker, and the forcing is weaker, and the flow is more the forcing has switched from a day-night forcing to an equator-to-pole forcing. And so you can imagine if you keep on going, you can kind of see the continuum to Jupiter, right? This is, even though this has less jets, this is essentially in the same dynamical regime as Jupiter is. Okay, thanks. So this shows the temperature structure for those exact simulations. Color scales are shown, with red being hot, blue being cold. Each one is rescaled, of course, from min to max on each plot. So in reality, these are the hot ones and these are the cold ones. These have temperatures in absolute terms of 1,000 K or more, whereas these are kind of a mean of sort of 400 K. But as far as the differences, which is what I want to emphasize, the ones down in this corner, again, have this very strong day-night forcing because they're getting a lot of stellar flux. The radiative time constant is short, so they have big day-night temperature differences. So you can see that here. Whereas up here, the rotation rates are fast and the radiative time constants are longer, and so it becomes much more homogenized in the east-west direction, just like happens on the rapidly rotating planets in our solar system, like Earth, for example. And so there's this shift in dynamical regime from this very strong sort of day-night forcing characteristic of sort of tidally locked hot Jupiters to the more sort of Earth or Jupiter-type forcing in this upper left part of the plot. I'm running short on time. You can see a similar regime shift here, even within the context of a single planet, if you change the metallicity, which changes the pressure level at which the starlight's being absorbed. It shows a sequence of simulations for GJ-436b from Nicole Lewis. When the metallicity is very high, the starlight is absorbed at low pressure, where the radiative time constant is short, so you're in this kind of day-night force regime down here. Whereas when the metallicity is much lower, say if the metallicity were much lower, say only solar, then the starlight's absorbed deeper, and the radiative time constants are longer, and the equator to pole forcing is more dominant, and you switch over into this kind of double jet structure. Okay, so there's a few challenges. So the last bit of the talk, I'm just going to describe sort of challenges and future directions. A big one, which has been pointed out by a number of people, Jeremy Goodman and others, sources of frictional damping are poorly understood. There are many possibilities. Subgrid scale turbulence, for example. So one could try to parameterize this, for example, with sort of a large scale damping that's supposed to represent, for example, the sort of aggregate effects of small turbulent eddies that you can't actually resolve in a model. Analogously, subgrid scale wave generation, breaking, and absorption, for example, is a nice poster by Watkins and Cho here, which I encourage you to see. Yet a third class of mechanisms would be drag and dissipation, ohmic dissipation associated with MHD effects. So there's a couple of nice papers posted on AstroPH by Perna et al. and Battagin and Stevenson, which have been talked about some already. So I encourage you to look at those. This shows a sequence of three simulations done by Emily Rauscher, which are part of this Perna et al. 2010 paper, just sort of illustrating very qualitatively the kind of effect this might have. So these, again, are simulations that are forced by Newtonian cooling, analogous to the simulations from their group that I showed earlier. And what's being shown again on here, just like those plots I showed you a minute ago, this is the east-west wind speed averaged over longitude shown versus latitude. So latitude is the x-axis and pressure is the y-axis. So equator is in the center of each plot, north pole on the right, south pole on the left. And the orange thing you're seeing here is the superrotating equatorial jet, which they're getting in their simulations like I do, and then with westward flow on each side. So on the left here, we have a case with weak drag. The way they implement the drag in this simulation is just literally a Rayleigh drag like I described. So they have a linear term that relaxes the wind speed towards zero over some chosen time scale, and they made that time scale a function of height. This is not intended to be a realistic representation of MHD effects. Their sole purpose was just to illustrate the point that a drag like this can have a dynamical effect on the flow. And so it's weak here, medium here, and strong here. So you're still in the same dynamical regime. You still have equatorial jet, but it affects the wind speeds, and this could in turn affect the offset of a hot point from the substellar point and things like that. So this will be an important area for future research. Also, just a general point, note that sometimes people talk about, what are the processes that equilibrate the zonal flows or so on, and this is a great question, one thing to think about is that there's no need to equilibrate the jet speed at a particular level, such as the photosphere, with drag at that level. You need drag somewhere, maybe, to equilibrate. But for example, you might have drag at the bottom in the context of a Jupiter model. Maybe you have drag way down deep in the interior at thousands of bars or deeper, and that soaks up kinetic energy. But at a given upper altitude, it's quite possible to have a force balance that does not involve the drag, at least in a major way. So, for example, what's fairly common in atmospheres is to have any jet pumping, a convergence of eddy momentum into the core of a jet, being balanced locally inside aloft by Coriolis forces and or advection. So just a good point to remember that we don't necessarily need drag, thank you, at the level of the photosphere. Okay, I'm running out of time here, but an interesting issue regards the time variability. Some 3D simulations have produced time variability and others have not. And so this is a complete speculation on my part, but I think it's a plausible direction to pursue about why that's taking place. Why are we seeing this divergence in model results? So a necessary condition for instability is that the latitudinal gradients of a quantity called the potential vorticity, which can very loosely be viewed as a representation of kind of angular momentum of a local fluid parcel, change signs somewhere within the domain. And a key point is that this is promoted by having an entropy gradient at a lower impermeable surface. That leads to a spike in the PV structure at the bottom and makes it much easier to have a change in the sign of the PV gradient inside the domain. In particular, baryclinic instability in Earth's atmosphere, which is the cause of the main mid-latitude weather. So for example, in the case of Earth, we have all these sort of arc-like clouds. So these are the result of baryclinic instability. One can simulate them. This shows a numerical simulation showing the development of these instabilities. So these occur in the atmosphere not because the PV gradient is changing sign in the interior of the atmosphere in general, but in general because there are entropy gradients at the surface. And so in a shallow model of a hot Jupiter, if you have a surface that's at shallow enough levels that there are entropy gradients on that surface, then those are conditions that can promote instabilities, which might not occur in reality if there is not a surface of that pressure. There are other possible, this applies only to baryclinic instabilities. It could also be the case that having a shallow atmosphere with a surface could also potentially promote barotropic or other types of instabilities. So this is an area for future research. Okay, I'm pretty much out of time here, I guess, so let's, okay. So the intense radiation produces winds on hot Jupiters that are fast, a kilometer a second or more, and large temperature contrasts. This can affect the temperature structure in a complex way. For example, if there's equatorial superrotation, that can displace hot regions away from the substellar point. Scaling arguments and 3D simulations pretty much agree that the flow structures are broad, unlike Jupiter and Saturn. There's a lot of work going on with our group and other groups trying to calculate detailed transmission and emission spectra from simulations. That's a growth area. There are interesting regime shifts that can occur when you change the rotation rate, the stellar flux, and metallicity and other parameters. And there's a number of challenges for the future from a theoretical point of view, such as understanding the sources of drag, diagnosing mechanisms for the circulation, understanding why some simulations are time variable and others are not so, and also just exploring the large range of diversities of eccentricities and distances from the star. This is really just the surface has only been scratched here. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, Adam. So, questions?
Jack Lissauer,
mm-hmm.
A very nice talk.
Thank you.
I was curious as to comparing a truly synchronous rotating planet deep down and one which has a slightly different rotation rate. And can you think of any observables for a, well, especially if you could, for a non-magnetized planet, but even for a magnetized planet, which might differentiate the two?
When you say slightly non-synchronous, how much do you mean?
Percent.
That's not going to affect meteorology much. I mean, we did simulations where we varied the rotation rate. Well, you saw that whole diagram on there. And we've also done ones that are sort of smaller variations, like factor of two deviations. And in that case, things look pretty similar. I mean, there are differences in the shape of the light curve and so on if you had factor of two deviations. But a percent is going to be tough.
So nothing affected by deep down
Well, I mean, there's probably subtleties with the tides that are not in these simulations, but as far as just the actual starlight flooding in and the force balances and the pumping of the jets and so on, I don't think it's going to be that important of an effect.
Adam, Nico Madhusudan here. I have a question on the details of how you treat radiative transfer in your models.
Okay.
I'm assuming it's not line by line, right?
No,
it
that's
should
right.
be some k, correlated k.
That's right.
Okay. Could you throw more light on that?
Okay,
that's
so
that's the first question. And the second question is, what is the time-limiting component of your coupled radiative hydrodynamic simulations?
Okay, so the radiative transfer model is just that from Marley and McKay, which Mark Marley has been using extensively to study brown dwarfs, and Jonathan Fortney has been using in the hot Jupiter context. When they use it, they are using it in a 1D, usually in a 1D radiative equilibrium configuration, where they have some iterative criterion that they want to satisfy to pound the solution into a radiative equilibrium. So they're not time-stepping the solution. So we turned off that iterative machinery, and then the bare bones then, the core of the code then, is a scheme for calculating upward and downward flux as a function of wavelength when you have a temperature pressure profile specified on a model column. And so in our case, we just run that on every model column and over some time step and then evolve the thing forward in a fully coupled way. As far as how we treat the opacities, as you said, it's a two-stream approximation. It's plane parallel, so it only treats the vertical fluxes. We do not treat the horizontal fluxes, so that's an approximation. It uses the correlated K method for the opacities. So what you do is you divide up the atmosphere into some number of bins. When they do it in 1D, they generally use roughly 200 bins. In these simulations, we use 30 bins. And then within each bin, there's information from sort of 10,000 to 100,000 frequency points, but it's still not line by line. That information is resorted in a statistical way. Loosely speaking, you could think of that as like, reshuffle all of the frequency points so you have a very smooth plot of like how the opacity varies with, tiny bin. And so that statistical information is used within each of our 30 bins to then determine what the sort of net opacities would be. We've done tests on how many bins are needed.
We should go because this is very specific.
Okay. Sure. Let me mention the final point, which is that so you asked about the timescales that are needed. So when you do it in this configuration, it's really the radiative transfer actually that's the bottleneck. So we'll leave it at that maybe.
Great talk, Adam. Question, given the wind velocities you mentioned in the atmospheric profile of these planets, I would expect shocks to occur in the outermost part of your simulations, of the layers. And how do you treat these shocks? Or can your calculations extend to low Mach or Mach unity numbers?
These particular simulations are not, you know, would not have a proper representation of shocks, particularly acoustic shocks. I mean, you could have, you know, hydraulic jumps, sort of gravity wave shocks, but we don't have any special schemes for dealing with that in these simulations. We do see that in some cases. The simulation that I showed had those developing only near the very top of the simulation, actually quite a bit above where the radiation is escaping the space. So for that particular simulation, I don't think it's going to affect the results very strongly. Some other simulations we've done have those in a more strong way. But I agree that's an area for future work.
Yes, Adam. Could you say a few words about the downward kinetic energy transport, whether you're still finding that in your latest models, and also what happens for the deep atmosphere? Whether have you homogenized the temperature field in all cases, or do you still see some variations in temperature?
Things tend to become homogenized at depth, at least relative to the top. That doesn't mean the temperature variations are zero, though. They can still develop. As far as pumping kinetic energy downward, of course, our paper in 2002 was the way the model was set up, had a hard time evaluating that rigorously. But it's still an idea that I think is a contender. We do see downward penetration of kinetic energy, and there's a number of mechanisms by which that can happen. So, for example, meridional circulations extend deeply, and in addition to that, waves could be small-scale gravity waves of the kind that Watkins and Cho are fooling around with, or in the case of our simulations, just the global scale sort of Rossby waves that are triggered by the thermal forcing. Those can propagate downward as well. But as far as quantitative details, I'm not sure if the numbers are going to work out, but it's something I'd like to return to actually evaluate it quantitatively.
Hi, Adam, how are you doing? I'm Matt Umerhan. I had a couple of comments to make. Number one, and this is a general sort of open question to the community. I mean, if the Rossby numbers here are order one in this particular case, Are using GCM models still appropriate, would you say, in this case? And number two, I was kind of curious about what your feelings were. This question's a little loaded. I mean, there's also issues having to do with initial conditions and how you seed these simulations. I was wondering if you could make a comment about that. And number three.
No, let me do those first, otherwise I'm going to forget.
Okay, fair enough.
So let's see. As far as the issue of the Rossby number, yeah. So I know that you've been playing with quasi-geostrophic models that specifically make a formal assumption that you're close to geostrophy.
And then MHD effects folded into that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, good point. But these GCMs do not make any assumption like that. So these GCMs, there is the issue of hydrostatic balance, right? So if hydrostatic balance is not satisfied, that's a different ball of wax. But there is no restrictive assumption whatsoever on the Rossby number. In fact, these same dynamical equations are perfectly valid and, in fact, are used to study the atmospheric circulation on Venus, where the Rossby numbers are kind of 10 to 100 in the cloud layer. So. Oh, initial. Let's talk about that offline.
Very nice talk, Adam. I just wanted to reinforce the point about drag. Drag isn't a detail for a couple of reasons. For one thing, without some sort of drag, there can be no equilibrium. You have the atmosphere is absorbing heat at a high temperature on the day side, rejecting it at a lower temperature on the night side. That makes it a heat engine. So without drag, the winds would flow faster and faster and faster and faster.
That's not necessarily true, actually. I mean, as you pointed out in your own paper, I mean, you can potentially move to a configuration where the efficiency of the heat engine goes to zero.
Or the hot spots on the terminator. Yes, I agree. But I mean, it just brings up the point that the primary observable, which is the redistribution of heat in the infrared phase curve, is very closely connected to this heat engine.
That's right, yeah. If I just follow up on that point before you continue, there are idealized simulations in shallow water equations, for example, where if you put damping only a thermal damping, there are known examples in the literature where one can equilibrate the winds. It's not the case that if you turn the drag off in those simulations that you go on forever.
That can't be true if fluid elements are absorbing. Fluid elements are returning to their original entropy and absorbing heat at high temperature, rejecting it at lower temperature. It can be true with some sort of artificial schemes that don't really represent real radiative heating.
Well, I mean, if you turn off the drag, then...
But let me make my second point. The other reason it's important is this heat engine is, of course, drawing on the largest power source in the problem, the insulation. And that the dissipation of that power, whatever power goes into the winds, could be essential for other things like, as Tristan has commented, the evolution of the interior of the planet, for example, mixing of the atmosphere or whatever. So, and a final point, if you have hydraulic jumps in your simulation, then you are not conserving energy. It means you've not got enough drag, because those jumps don't conserve energy. That may or may not be a detail, but.
Yeah, that has not actually been proved in the primitive equations. In the shallow water equations, that must be true. It would be misleading to suggest that the shallow water equations, for example, should conserve energy, because in that case, there's no thermal energy budget. That theoretical issue has not been addressed in the context of the primitive equations. Nevertheless, I think you're probably right that to the extent that there are hydraulic jumps in the primitive equations, there, because those are small-scale features, they're not, the hydrostatic approximation is not valid at those features. So, and I think you're right. I mean, there's one has to look at whether there's dissipation associated with that.
So I'm sorry. I think we have to interrupt this important discussion, but we are running out of time. So we stop here.
Okay.